Walt Disney once wrote, "In the lexicon of youth, there is no such word as fail." Remember the story about the boy who wanted to march in the circus parade? When the show came to town, the bandmaster needed a trombonist, so the boy signed up. He hadn't marched a block before the fearful noises from his horn caused two old ladies to faint and a horse to run away. The bandmaster demanded, "Why didn't you tell me you couldn't play the trombone?" And the boy said, "How did I know? I never tried before." Many years ago, I might have done just what that boy did. Now I'm a grandfather and have a good many gray hairs and what a lot of people would call common sense. But if I'm no longer young in age, I hope I stay young enough in spirit never to fear failure. Young enough still to take a chance and march in the parade. This was the philosophy of one man, Walt Disney.
My dad worked as a carpenter in Chicago on the World's Fair buildings. He worked for a dollar a day. And out of that, he and my mother saved enough money to go in business. Eventually, he ended up in Chicago as a contractor. My mother drew the plans. My dad would build the houses, and he was doing that when I was born. December 5th, 1901. My dad made some money as a contractor, and he wanted to get back to the farm. They finally ended up buying this farm in Marceline, Missouri. I had two pals. One of them was Grandpa Taylor, who was a Civil War veteran. And another one was a retired doctor by the name of Doc Sherwood. And Doc had this beautiful stallion, Rupert. Doc had me come over one time and brought my crayons and my big cheap tablet, and I was going to draw a picture of Rupert for him. He was going to give me a nickel or something. But this day, I've never seen Rupert so restless. And I was trying to draw him, and I'd get one stick down for a leg, and then Rupert would turn around. Then I'd have from a profile, I'd move around the front view, and Doc couldn't hold Rupert still. So it turned out to be quite a mess, but he liked it.
Things got pretty tough on the farm. My dad had a sickness, and they decided to sell the farm. But then he had to auction all the stock and things. And it was in the cold of the winter, and I remember Roy and myself going out and going all around to the different little towns and places, tacking up these posters of the auction. So they sold out, took the money, and they went to Kansas City.
My dad bought this Kansas City Star route. You know, Star route was quite a thing. They gave me a small route. Oh, I must have had 50 customers. I was about 9 or 10 when I started that. In the winter, we'd go out at 3:30 in the morning right after a blizzard or in a blizzard or in pouring rain. It didn't matter. I did that for 6 years. It was tough.
It was 1917, and moved to Chicago, and I didn't move.
In the meantime, Brother Roy had joined the Navy, so I wanted to join it. Another boy, I don't think he's as old as I was, but he looked older. We went to the Navy, and they turned us down. He was being too young. Finally, this kid come in to me very excited. He says, "There's something just for me here that you and I can get in." I said, "What is it?" He says, "An ambulance unit." So we went down and signed up, and we're on our way to France. And we became replacements. I was assigned to an evacuation hospital number 5 in Paris. I had my drawing board right by my bunk. So I started painting pictures all over my truck.
The doughboy I used in a lot of these cartoons, this doughboy with this beaming face.
I was in Paris, 3rd of September, and Pershing pulled out. The whole headquarters company left. All the guys I knew had gone.
Paris, which had been this exciting thing with all these soldiers and things, suddenly there wasn't a soldier to be seen. And I suddenly became very lonesome. So then I went in, put a request in to be discharged. And I left shortly after that to come home. So I hit Chicago. That's where my parents were living. And my father said, Walter, Mr. Scroggins, he's got a job for you, $25 a week and all of that. And I said, Dad, I want to be an artist. And my dad, he just couldn't buy that. So I went to Kansas City, and Roy was in Kansas City working in a bank. So I went into this Kansas City film ad company. So that was where I got started in the animation business. The first money that I made, I bought myself a motion picture camera called the Universal. But I wanted to experiment making the theatrical cartoons. So I started experimenting at night. And I worked on a little idea that I had that I wanted to sell to the Newman Theater, a chain of about three theaters. So I called the things Newman Laugh-O-Grams. Well, I was desperately trying to get something that would get a hold, could catch on. So I was thinking if I had something with a novel twist, I might crack the market. They had had the cartoons working with the humans. The cartoon would always come off the drawing board and run around in a real room and work with a real person. I said, well, maybe I'll pull a reversal on that. I'll put the humans in with the cartoon. I found a little girl that had been posing for some of the commercial things. But I still couldn't get anywhere with it, and the company began to collapse. There was no money coming in. So there's nothing left but to go into bankruptcy. I'd failed. But I learned a lot out of that. And I think it's important to have a good, hard failure when you're young, you know? And it was a big day, the day I got on that California Limited and came to Hollywood. It was in July, I think, 1923. I was 21 going on 22.
Now, my brother Roy was already in Los Angeles. Both of us were unemployed. We solved the problem by going into business for ourselves. We established the first animated cartoon studio in Hollywood. Several years of producing one series after another on shoestring budgets followed. Then sound and film panicked the industry.
I'd walk a million miles.
Mickey Mouse came into our life.
He popped out of my mind onto a drawing pad on a train ride from Manhattan to Hollywood at a time when the business fortunes of my brother Roy and myself were at lowest ebb and disaster seemed right around the corner. Mickey's first actual screen appearance was at the Old Colony Theater in New York in Steamboat Willie. I did the voice. Mickey was the first cartoon character to stress personality. I thought of him from the first as a distinct individual, not just a cartoon type or symbol going through comedy routines. Mickey was simply a little personality assigned to the purposes of laughter.
By nature, I'm an experimenter, so with the success of Mickey, I was determined to diversify. I had another idea which was plaguing my brain. It was the Silly Symphonies. It was a series without a central character. With a series like that, I felt it would give me a chance to really develop my medium. The first of that series was called The Skeleton Dance.
Technicolor about that time came out with their three-color process. I was very excited about it. I had a picture in work called Flowers and Trees. I had finished about half of it in black and white. But I just felt that this color would do so much for the cartoon medium that it was worth doing the picture over. Flowers and Trees opened with Eugene O'Neill's Strange Interlude at the Chinese Theater. And fortunately for me, it did hit Flowers and Trees when I won an Academy Award, the first cartoon to ever win an Academy Award. Well, the Three Little Pigs followed sometime in early 33. Very warm reception from the audience. All the little pigs seemed to register with them, and it was the thing we'd been working for a long time, personality out of the character. Individual personality. I saw the handwriting on the wall early. It was a short subject, it's just a filler on any program. I just felt I just had to diversify my business. Now, if I could crack the feature field, I could do things. I had done a little story research on different fairy tales I might do, and Snow White was one of them. It's a thing I remembered as a kid. I saw it in Kansas City one time when I was a newsboy. They had a big showing for all the newsboys, and I went and saw Snow White. It's probably one of my first big feature pictures I'd ever seen. Anyway, to me, I thought it was a perfect story. I had the heavy, I had the prince and the girl, the romance. I had the sympathetic dwarfs and things. I wanted to, no doubt about the personality, so I sort of picked a name to fit the personality. So when I had bashful, he was bashful. I had happy, he was happy. I had dopey, he was dopey. I got voices for everybody.
Look! The floor! It's been swept!
Hey, but we couldn't find a voice for Dopey. So we said, well, let's let him be mute, you see? We just won't give him a voice. That'll make him different. And it worked. We started Snow White sometime late 35, and we had it running in the theaters December 37. So actually, it was around 2 years in the making. Big premiere, the Carthay Circle Theater, big grand Hollywood premiere. All of Hollywood brass turned out for a cartoon.
The daddy of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs is going to get this beautiful statue. Isn't it bright and shiny?
With the profits of Snow White, I built a studio. The studio ended up costing us around $3 million. By 1940-something, we owed the bank $4.5 million. But I had all these pictures in work. Pinocchio, Bambi, Fantasia. I had Fantasia set for a widescreen. I had dimensional sound. Because that widescreen, I had the projector running sideways. But I didn't get to building my cameras or my projectors because the money problem came in. I think if I'd have had the money, if I could have gone ahead, I'd have had a really sensational show at that time. During the war, we did briefing films for the Marine Corps on the landings on the island, and they were all very top secret. We did a heck of a lot of islands I've never heard of. I think we did over 4,000 in Sydney. But after the war, there's quite a problem picking up the pieces. I want to go beyond the cartoon. Thought if I could get into the live end, that there's things I could do. I wanted
but to see if I couldn't do something with him in an educational way. So I sent this crew to Alaska, and I got a group of educators together. We discussed what we might do. And out of it, I came up with this. It can be educational, but don't label it as such. So I took the film that I'd shot about the seals on this island, made it into an entertainment package. I coined this title, True to Life Adventure. And I wanted enough different types of things that I could do with my organization that I could say I could fall on my nose with one of these pictures, but I had another one right behind it that would hit. So then I started out, and the first one I think I did there was Cinderella. Then the next one on the schedule was Alice, but I had another one coming right behind it. I had Peter Pan. Cinderella hit, made a lot of money. Alice, one of them came out and just made a nosedive. You see, Cinderella, you pulled for Cinderella. You fell for Cinderella. Alice, there are millions of people didn't care about Alice. There's no heart to it. Without that heart, you see, I don't think anything will last. In other words, with every laugh, there must be a tear somewhere, and I believe in that.
After long concentration on live action and cartoon films, we decided to try something that would employ about every trick we had learned in the making of films. We would combine cartoon, live action, in an enormous fantasy, Mary Poppins. What a far cry that was from Snow White. As the original Mary Poppins budget of $5 million continued to grow, I never saw a sad face around the studio. This made me nervous. I knew the picture would have to gross $10 million for us to break even. But still, there was no negative head shaking, no prophets of doom. Even my brother Roy was happy. He didn't even ask me to show the thing to a banker before it was finished. Then the horrible thought struck me. Suppose the staff had finally conceded that I knew what I was doing.
When Mary owns your hand, you feel so grand. Your heart starts beating like a big brass band.
Television was the start of Disneyland. The idea for a Disneyland lay dormant all those years. It came along when I was taking my kids around to these kiddie parks, and I'd take them around, and we used to go out on every Saturday and Sunday, everywhere, zoos and parks, and parks form and things. And while they were on the merry-go-round riding 40 times or something, you know, I'd be sitting there trying to figure what she could do. And when I built the studio, I thought, well, gee, we ought to have a three-dimensional thing that people could actually come and visit. So every time I get thinking of television, I would think of this park. And I knew that if I did anything like the park, I had to have some kind of a medium like television to let the people know about it. So I said, well, here's the way I'll get my park going. So I just sort of insisted that my Disneyland park be a part of my television. Well, I have Adventureland, Tomorrowland, Frontierland. It brings in the things that I want to do, that I'm interested in. I'm interested in fantasy. I'm interested in the world tomorrow, which is vital to us. In the park, I want to get exhibits and things that do the same thing, but they're three-dimensional things. Frontierland, I've always been interested in the past and history, and I think it's vital. I think that in this world we're living in today, in this new era that we're going in, we can't forget the things that happened, such as, I mean, the founding fathers and that Constitution, which is such a vital thing to what we're doing today. Well, that's what I believe in there, you see. Park means a lot to me in that something will never be finished. Something that I can keep developing and adding to. Not only can I add things, but even the trees will keep growing. The thing will get more beautiful every year.
Now,
I want to share with you some of our ideas, some of the philosophy for Disney World.
I've always said there will never be another Disneyland, and I think it's going to work out that way,
so that there is a distinction between Disneyland in California and whatever Disney does in Florida. Here in Florida, we have something special we never enjoyed at Disneyland, the blessing of size. There's enough land to hold all the ideas and plans we can possibly imagine. It will be a community of tomorrow that will never be completed. But the most exciting, and by far the most important part of our Florida project, in fact, the heart of everything we'll be doing in Disney World, will be our experimental prototype city of tomorrow. It will never cease to be a living blueprint of the future, where people actually live a life they can't find anywhere else in the world. You know, I was stumped one day when a little boy asked, "Do you draw Mickey Mouse?" And I had to admit I do not draw anymore. "Well, then you think up all the jokes and ideas." "No," I said, "I don't do that." Finally, he looked at me and said, "Mr. Disney, just what do you do?" "Well," I said, "sometimes I think of myself as a little bee. I go from one area of the studio to another and gather pollen and sort of stimulate everybody. I guess that's the job I do."
Well, after 40-some-odd years in the business, my greatest reward, I think, is that I've been able to build this wonderful organization, also to have the public appreciate and accept what I've done all these years. That is a great reward. But all individuals are different. Some of us just wouldn't be satisfied with just carrying out a routine job and being happy. Yet I envy those people. I had a brother who I really envied because he was a mailman. But he was the one that had all the fun. He had himself a trailer, and he used to go off and go fishing, and he didn't worry about payrolls and stories and picture grocers or anything. And he was the happy one. I always said, he's the smart Disney.